You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 298, how technology has killed off the art of recording music from the radio onto cassettes. Bummer, it was so much fun. And coming soon to a football pitch near you, video referees. What on earth? And you look inside number 9. It's all coming up after Oasis and Up in the Sky.
Welcome to my world. I do like that. It makes you want to jump up and down a lot, which is always good news, I think. That is Oasis. It's Up in the Sky, which came from their much loved by many debut album, Definitely Maybe, which was, I think, it for ages it had the record as the fastest selling debut album, I think. I can't remember if we talked about this in the podcast or not, Terence, but who do you think had the fastest selling debut album last year?
Oh, last year? Oh, God.
Yeah, 2016.
Don't know. Rose, I can't even think.
Bro broke the record that had been
Sheeran, by... Adele? No.
Oh, your friend of mine, Bradley Walsh.
Oh, gosh, yes. Oh, his Christmas hit.
His covers of standards, which everyone bought for their grannies, or grannies bought, because those kind of people only buy, they're the only people that buy CDs now. And so Bradley Walsh, I think, beat the Arctic Monkeys record of the fastest selling debut album. And in between those two records, it was Elastica by Elastica that took the record off, Definitely Maybe. So that's one for you Stat fans, those cheery Oasis chaps in happier times.
23 years ago.
Oh, don't.
Welcome to the podcast from the Parish Council. It's episode 298. Don't mention it's 307 if you add in the special.
No,
don't mention it. I'm Terence Stackham, and she's not maybe, she's definitely Juliet Harris.
Thank you very much. Here I am, wheeling in my stroller, ready to interrupt. I know this is not, we're not meant to be talking about this week, but oh, that video. I keep wanting to be crossly feminist about the fact that he bats. So in case anybody's living under a rock and hasn't seen this, it's gone really very viral, to use the expression. A chap was being interviewed by BBC News about North and South Korea. There was obviously some kind of a academic expert about it. Unfortunately, the interview, he was Skyping from home, and the interview was interrupted by, firstly, his daughter, and then I think the second child, I think is a girl as well, who then came wheeling in on a stroller in the background. And there was an intervention, a hurried intervention by the mum, that then skidded in across the floor and had to take them away and crawled out of the room and shut the door. And then you heard the kids screaming in the background. I think, like Betty, I wanted to get a bit crossly feminist about the fact that he just batted the child away. But it's when that kid comes in on the wheels, it's just so good. Everything about that video is... The Telegraph did a 13-point summary of why it is comedy genius. And it is so good. It's the moment when he realises that when he blinks and realizes that actually doesn't matter what he's saying at all now, no one is listening, and then when he becomes so confused by the kids screaming and so distracted that he then confuses North and South Korea. I think that's possibly my favorite bit, but everything about that, we are deeply in love with that man, his wife and their children.
Why, so it's
on wheels in tribute to that.
It's like three layers of comedy. It's like Buster Keaton at his best.
It's going to live on for years because it's just accidental genius.
The first kid comes in, the daughter who can walk, and she's like Bez of the Happy Mondays, didn't we?
Swaggering in those bizarre kind of pink glasses as well.
Right. Marvellous. And then, as you say, the second child comes in. You know, just when you think, oh, that's funny, that's cute, then in comes Bowles' second kid. Of course, they had to be in this stroller, which just adds to the thing. And then, as I say, the sort of Charlie Chaplin-esque Keystone Cops moment with the mother coming, skidding in, slithering in, grabbing the children, and then...
I've said it so many times, and I'm still... I mean, this is slightly dialed back hysteria about it. I mean, I can just about watch it without weeping with laughter now, but it has taken many watches to get to that point. And now, of course, they're sensations, aren't they? They're being interviewed about the fact that you know, that basically what happened. The grand... I love the fact as well that because where they lived, I can't remember, it was somewhere where there was a 14-hour time difference. The granny basically said on the lines that he probably doesn't even realise it's gone viral because they've gone to bed. Yes. And the granny said something like that. Apparently, they always talk to them by Skype, so that she thinks the grandkids thought it was her on Skype, and so of course ran in overexcited to speak to her. Oh, the book's falling off the bed as well. That's also an excellent point.
Yes.
But they've lined up these very clever-looking books on the bed in the background to make themselves look, you know, super brainy. And then they get knocked off by the child, and then the mum's kind of chaotic entrance.
It's like a full sort of comedy half hour in like 3 seconds. It's the most marvellous.
4 seconds in total, which is why when I went to show it to my mum, we went, oh, I don't want to watch a long, boring video. No, mum, it's less than a minute, but every second is gold. I mean, the way that is plotted, they don't waste any time at all.
Absolutely not. So it's, and this poor man, no matter what academic heights he reaches, he'll only ever now be remembered for this.
The man from the video with his children, yeah.
We were talking last week about a time when it felt like the top 40 mattered. It was one of our subjects. And how we felt...
Yes.
Yeah, a sense of personal triumph if one of our favourite groups or singers moved up the charts. And, of course, this also coincided with the rise of home taping. And despite all those warning advertisements and inserts...
Home taping is killing music. You can buy T-shirts with that on now.
Oh, can you? I don't know. They used to insert little cards in record sleeves. Yeah. Well, we all carried on with abandon. Now, do you remember sitting poised with your fingers on play and record, ready to clunk those buttons down?
Do I? Yeah, of course I do. It's how I live my life, man. I have many, many tapes, and actually I still occasionally find old mixtapes, and we'll go on to talk about making mixtapes for others in a bit, I suspect, but for making mixtapes for my own use, stuff that we must all remember, of course, that there wasn't, I mean, when we were regularly listening to radio in our respective eras, there wasn't iTunes, so you couldn't just buy a song. If you wanted it, that was not a thing you could do unless it was a single. And so if there was a song and you didn't necessarily want to buy the single, or you couldn't buy the single for whatever reason, or you didn't want to buy the whole album, you'd tape it off the radio. And I used to listen to the Evening Session a lot as well, Steve Lamacq. So Joe Wine, Steve Lamacq, and then Steve Lamacq, and of course John Peel. And most indie fans I know have loads of John Peel session tapes at home, which we all used to tape off the radio. It was stuff that quite often, because Hastings was not, a bit limited in its music buying options, if it wasn't at Al Price or Woolworths, then it really wasn't available. Often you wouldn't be able to, I would find it really hard to get hold of stuff that had been played on John Peel. I couldn't necessarily go to Brighton or London regularly, which is where I could buy things. So that was a real lifeline, being able to sort of tape John Peel. But I found a tape recently. Of course, sometimes if I was being particularly lazy, rather than trying to, beat the intro of the talking and then get the tune, I just leave it on. And I found a tape the other day, and it had a news bulletin in it. So, of course, you could date it to what it was. And put it this way, this news bulletin excitedly explained how England had reached the semi-finals of Euro 96.
Oh,
so
wow.
I think this tape was quite old. Years old, in fact. So very, very big fan of home tape. We used to have this huge... I talked to my parents about this the other day. We used to have this huge... a sort of leatherette type case. It wasn't really a suitcase because it was a really weird shape. It was maybe a few inches high, and it was really, really sort of big. It was almost like a sort of a dining room table sized, but it was really not very thick. And it existed purely to keep copied TDK C90 tapes in that well wishers had given to us. Or indeed, my mum said that she was the kind of go-to person at Hastings Borough Council because they had a good quality sort of hi-fi thing. Dad said to me the other day he remembers the man that brought it round, that had a sports car that he vaulted in and out of and had a cigarette tucked behind his ear, and a young lady friend that was not his wife that was waiting in the car. So it was very much a kind of a Jack the Lad growth industry then, I think, when he came to fit the stereo. It was sort of a ceremonial thing, I think. And so they... My mum was a kind of go-to bootlegger, really, of Hastings Borough Council. They used to give people Led Zeppelin tapes and that, I think. So, I am. I used to often have nightmares as a five-year-old that we would get raided, that the tape police would turn up at our house and take us all. And more importantly, I wouldn't have minded being taken away. But, I really liked that Shaman tape. I didn't want to lose it. So, big fan of home.
My earliest engagement with home taping, in retrospect, it was incredibly amateurish, but despite that, it's led to repercussions that still live with me today. Because it was May 1967, I was 11 years old.
Ooh, back
and
in the day.
The only way that I could hear all the pop music I loved, there was no Radio 1, the only way I could listen to music was by tuning into the pirate radio ships. And Radio London was my choice. It was literally bobbing about on the North Sea. And they announced that they had the exclusive to play the whole of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. It was a few weeks ahead of its official release date. Now, wait for this. The show was jointly presented, of course, by John Peel and...
Of course, yeah.
Ed Stewpot Stewart.
I remember him.
An unlikely pairing. Radio London, they were convinced... Yes. Probably rightly, that other radio stations would record the album off air and play it out, as their own. So Radio London, what they did was they broke up each of the songs when they were, this exclusive airing of Sgt. Pepper, they broke up the songs with idents and jingles. So
yes.
Now, I was desperate to hear and hear again the new Beatles album. I recorded the Peel Ed Stewart show on this really old, really clunky reel-to-reel tape machine. It was before the advent of cassettes. Mm. It was a reel-to-reel thing. And through that summer, I must have played that jingle-enhanced version of Sgt. Pepper hundreds and hundreds of times. So it's the jingle version that's remained in my brain with such ferocity that to this day, I hear it like this. I read the news today, oh boy, wonderful Radio London, about a lucky man who made the grade.
It's very poignant, yeah.
It's Big L. And, you know, but then that summer, your Tony Benn came along and closed all the pirate ships down and bequeathed us BBC Radio 1. So Tony Benn ruined my childhood, essentially.
Well, I I'm sorry for that. And I have to say, he's become less my Tony Benn as the years are rolling on, if it makes you feel any better. Though I still do have an Obama-style Hope-type picture of him with a Benn underneath on my studio door that I won in a Labour Party auction. Mm. So, yeah, all things which are no longer happening in my life. But, yes, yes, I am sorry for your loss. But if it makes you feel any better, I did a similar thing. This is The Generations, and quite an apt band in comparison, this. Mm. A famed Beatles copyist, Oasis, had an album called Be Here Now, which was very much anticipated in 1997. Everyone very excited about it coming out. Everyone really wanting to hear it. Steve Lamacq wrote an excellent book called Going Deaf for a Living, which I certainly made an impact on me as a ute. And I would recommend reading it because he's very honest, actually. I mean, it's not necessarily deep thinking stuff, but he is very interesting, and he talks about the nightmare that was trying to get an exclusive unveiling of Be Here Now. And initially they'd agreed, the creation agreed to give them a whole album, and then they said it was only going to be six songs, and he said it was completely off-putting because they asked him to play a jingle in the middle of one of the tracks, and he refused.
Oh, really?
And said no, I'm not doing it, it's going to sound awful, I'm not doing it. And in the end, they got given three tracks one night, but because they felt that he hadn't talked enough over the songs, they then weren't given any more for the rest of the week. So he said it was incredibly embarrassing having to go on air and go, sorry guys, we haven't got those tracks after all, because they've been trading it, obviously. So I think it just showed the level of paranoia that sort of creation had around Oasis at that point. And this was, you know, not in the age of the internet, really. Mm. I think there were some very... They'd gone into, they burned through a lot of their ill will by trying to prosecute fans that had, you know, very basic websites that were fan sites, really. I mean, you know, the days of GeoCities, this wasn't exactly bootlegging, really. What they were doing, I think, they weren't even sending out promo CDs. They were taking journalists round in cars, I think, and playing it in the car. But that shows enormous amounts of, like you say, the idea, and also interesting that, maybe, I don't know, maybe Steve Lamacq saw himself as a different type of DJ, that he kind of balked at the idea of playing stuff in the middle of a track. And in a way, I kind of admire him, because it's kind of saying to the self-proclaimed most important band in the world, well, no, you're not actually, we'll just play some other records instead.
Yeah, well, hats off to Steve Lamacq, who I've got a great deal of time for.
Yes, and I would recommend that book, it is really interesting.
Mm. Video refs are a-coming. That'll solve everything, won't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
That's next after Tennis and Origins. Denver, Colorado. The Tennis is the name of the band, and from the second of their four albums to date, from December 2011, that track was Origins.
I'm a big fan of Tennis. I think they're great.
Yeah, tremendous for them. So new album just out, actually. Yeah, husband and wife duo, they met in a philosophy class at the University of Colorado, which is as good a place as anywhere to start a band, I suppose.
Quite, yeah, indeed.
It's a penalty! Oh, wait! The referee didn't see it, and Jose Mourinho is going berserk at the fourth official on the touchline there.
Jose, yeah.
It's a familiar tale, but hold on. Video referees are coming your way soon, or to give them their full title, Video Assistant Referees VARs.
Excellent, and they like jams. We've heard so much about jams recently, haven't we? They're just about managers. Every day brings a new wacky acronym, or a whacronym, I suppose, at the moment.
This is a new system. It's going to be tried out in next season. FA Cup. Mm-hmm. And then
the FA Cup always gets the short straw.
It really does. Yeah, so we've got some newfangled idea. Oh, stick it in the FA Cup.
The magic of the FA Cup. It can only add to the fabled magic of the FA Cup. Did we mention that the FA Cup was magical? Because it contained real magic. Thanks, BBC One.
Its successor otherwise will then be reviewed before these VARs are potentially rolled out to wider football. Now, the word is that these video reviews will only adjudicate on specific issues. When a clear error has been made by the referee on whether a goal has been scored, a penalty should or shouldn't be awarded, straight red card incidents, and cases of mistaken identity. Now, Jules, will this remove, do you think, some of the natural drama of a game and add in lengthy delays? Or should we accept, really, that this is a sensible use of technology? I don't know.
Well, indeed. I'm not sure I do, but I'll try and form an opinion if I can, because that's sort of the point of this, really, isn't it? If I was working at a tabloid newspaper, which, you know, is implausible, but not outside the realms
of possibility, not out of the question.
I would be thinking on the lines of a video killed the football star type headlines. I know that would work, wouldn't it, in a kind of a terrible way. Yes, I mean, so like you say, the bits in football that are the most interesting bits are the bits that contain the incident. I watched the Chelsea-Manchester United FA Cup match the other day. It was on early this week.
Glorious victory for my boys in blue.
Indeed, yes. Although, having said that, Manchester United got as close as anyone, I think, has done this season to working out how to, if not beat Chelsea, at least stop them for a bit, I think. I very much enjoyed, by the way, and this is slightly off topic, but Terence and I are big fans of David Squires, the cartoonist in The Guardian, who does weekly strips, and they are brilliant. If you haven't read them, they are worth looking at, because they are always a riot of political references and occasional Simpsons references, which I like, and kind of general sort of cleverness. And the way that he constantly portrays Jose Mourinho as a petulant child is brilliant. There was a previous episode of the cartoon where he told someone, I think it was the one of the managers, who said, "Oh, you've ruined my week. You can't come to my birthday party at Laser Quest now." It's just about summed him up, I think, this week. That he drew him as the adult that stormed off of Robot Wars when they got beaten by a team of children, which is exactly the sort of thing that Jose Mourinho would do. So very much enjoying sort of childlike Jose. But it's part of me thinks back to, for example, Frank Lampard's goal when England lost to Germany during that World Cup, which was a perfectly good goal. A Sol Campbell-headed goal at a World Cup as well that was ruled out. So the England fan in me thinks, oh, good, no longer will we have these miscarriages of justice, thumps table with fist. But part of me, like you, thinks, well, the thing that makes football so interesting is when it all goes a bit chaotic, really. And that's the skill of a referee, I suppose, and that's why we have a referee, you know, because someone can make judgments about things, and, you know, some referees are better than others. I enjoyed Jose Mourinho sardonically offering his congratulations to was it Mr. Oliver or whatever the referee was called? He called him Mr., which I thought was quite entertaining. But I think that, you know, human nature is the fact that referees aren't going to spot everything. And I think it comes down to sort of a deep philosophical choice, I think, really, which is, do we just accept that referees aren't going to pick everything up, and neither will their assistants, and that is just human frailty, and football is a battle of human nature and human will, and therefore we embrace that? Or are we saying, because there is so much money invested in football now, and I think this is probably relevant, that it is such an industry in itself, are we saying, that we can't, that's a failure of industry if, you know, wrong decisions are made? Are we really saying that we want football to be this efficient process whereby nothing is ever wrong? And I'm not sure I do, really. I think it will take away from the drama. Ultimately, I suppose it's just going to offer an excuse. All it's going to do is actually, the only thing I would like about it is it will take away a nice level of excuse from the Mourinhos and the Wengers of this world, who, you know, always turn around and go, oh, I didn't. He never sees anything, Arsene, does he?
No, he never saw it.
Terrible. Let's all raise money for his cataract operation. It's clearly a great affliction of him. But do you know what I mean? So we'll take away a convenient tranche of excuses to them. So when Jose says, oh, the referee shouldn't give it a penalty. Well, no, mate. The referee decided it wasn't a penalty. The cast of thousands that are his assistants nowadays decided it wasn't a penalty. And we've just all sat and watched that rubbish again, and it wasn't a penalty. So guess what? Maybe your team just weren't good enough because you manage them and you weren't good enough. Here you go, Jose. Here's a bus ticket home. I quite like the idea of, you know, of calming down managers and their ridiculous excuses. So in a way, there is no hiding place. And although referees, video referees, maybe VARs might be met, sort of welcomed by players and managers, it does strip away a level of excuses from them.
The stifling of Mourinho is probably the best argument for it altogether. But anything that reduces the amount of cheating, and in particular diving or simulation, as they call it, to win free kicks or penalties, that's got to be welcomed. I mean, this very week, you may not have seen this, I don't think you have the channel, but we saw Jamie Vardy reeling in the Champions League.
That man winds me up. How can someone fall from grace from being a good lad one season to being a complete numbnut the next?
It was like he'd been hit by a hammer after the merest brush with the unlikeliest of villains, Samir Nasri. If it cuts back on that sort of tomfoolery, that's great news. But one aspect that troubles me is that, unlike cricket in particular, tennis, even rugby actually, football isn't by nature a stop-start game. There often isn't a natural pause after an incident. And it'll seem really unnatural if we have to wait for a break in play to alert the referee to a review, especially, and this is what I was thinking, if there's been another incident in between. So what if, say, Dele Alli or Diego Costa scores a goal, but the video assistant referee says the play's got to be pulled back, maybe even should have been sent off 30 seconds earlier because of a serious foul. Imagine the uproar then. That goal's disallowed. I can see someone like Mourinho running up the stairs to the video ref's room and banging on the door.
Absolutely. Yeah. I can't
let me in.
Agree. Absolutely. I demand it. I am king. Yes, King Jose being demanded to be let in. Yeah, I think that's a really good point, and I completely agree. It was just going to, otherwise, I think we've complained previously on Juliet and Terence's Complaints About Everything, which is the podcast sort of subtitle. I think we've complained about American sports previously, haven't we? And the fact that they are just, many American sports are, it's just a series of interruptions that then happens to have a bit of sport in the middle of it, really. I mean, but it takes many hours for basketball games to be completed, doesn't it? Because they start and stop the clock again, and they do the same with baseball, I think, sometimes, and all of those type sports. And it feels like you've been there. I think I saw a basketball game once somewhere, not an American one, sadly, an English one. By the end of the evening, I genuinely felt like I'd been there my whole life, because we'd taken so long. And of course, the problem was that they kept... The clock stopping and starting thing meant that, unfortunately, I think it was Guildford or somewhere like that, and they kept oh no, it was Brighton, because the Brighton Bears, I think, were quite famous, and they kept stopping and starting, and I think they had a Whitesnake song, but instead of pause, exactly, it was not a good start, and instead of pausing the track and then starting it again, they kept starting the track from the beginning every time they played it, and it was a complete mare. It was Here I Go Again, I think, which added to the humour, because we really did go again over and over and over and over again. So yeah, like you, I don't think that breaking up the flow really works, and I think that's why they dropped the kind of sick tackle rule in rugby, didn't they? Or at least that's not used so much now, because otherwise it was just every time the game got going, you had to stop.
I fear they'll see a commercial opportunity as well, so it'll be and now your video review brought to you by Ray Winston, and you know
exactly. Yeah. fucking go over the line. And or it's going to be, you know, oh, and here's a few messages from our sponsors. Whilst we get the video ready,
exactly.
here is an advert about a new flavour of Watsits, which, to be fair, I would be really interested in because I love Watsits, but you know what I mean. Or here's Coca-Cola minus two, the, you know, we actually, you lose weight drinking it, you know, whatever the next product's going to be. So, yes, I agree with you. I think this stinks. So let's see how we get on with it.
I've got one very last quick point to make about it. It's always tricky when technology is used at the top level but not available at lower leagues. Now, one of the beautiful aspects of football is that the rules are the same in the Premier League as they are for local Sunday morning teams.
Yeah,
but I rather suspect that when the Queen's Head play Marlow Rangers on a Sunday morning, they won't have an extra official guiding video reviews.
It's got to be someone's dad on a camcorder. I don't think it's going to work quite so well, is it? My final point on this is in true kind of butterfly effect, revisionist history style, if we'd had video referees long ago, England might never have won the World Cup.
Very true. That Russian linesman, he would have been overruled, wouldn't he?
And people want to leave Europe. I don't understand.
Yes. What's so great about Inside Number 9? We'll tell you right after Amy Winehouse.
Stellar album, which is, I think every song on that is a winner, but of all of them, I don't think that was a single. But I keep every so often, if I'm absent-mindedly doing something at work, I find myself going doodle doo doo. It's just such a catchy thing that keeps getting me. I had the enormous pleasure of seeing Amy Winehouse in concert, which I you know, it's a wonderful thing to be able to say now. Obviously, I wish it wasn't a wonderful thing, and that I wish she was still alive. Obviously, but I saw her pre Beehive as well. So it was when she was touring Frank in 2004 at my university, UEA in Norwich, and. She was clearly quite odd. I mean, there was no getting her out there. She was either a bit odd or a bit drunk or both. I suspect it might have been both. My favourite was when she was telling off the crowd for talking and then halfway through lost heart and then apologised for telling the crowd off. she was just great. I mean, and you know, she'd be someone who would seem a bit odd and then she'd sing and everything was just amazing. So that was He Can Only Hold Her, and it was from Back to Black.
An astonishing 6 years since she died, only 27 years old.
I can't believe that. I was talking to someone about it the other day, and she was a very similar age to me, I think. I think there's a few months between us. And for, you know, my generation of women of my sort of age, she, you know, it was almost like a kind of a JFK Martin Luther King moment, really. And I remember where I was in the Prince Albert in Brighton, funnily enough, having dinner with my former partner. It was the first time we'd seen each other in about 9 months, but it was lovely. It was nice to see her. And I remember us eating, and the pub started playing the record, and we were kind of talking, sort of saying, oh, you know, I really hope that she gets it together again, isn't she great, and oh god, isn't the dad intervening, never seems to do much good, and you know, or what, you know, what we're going to do. And then I was on my way to meet someone else, and as I just sort of got my phone out to text this person to say where I was going to be, it said Amy Winehouse has died. There was a news alert, and I just thought, what, you know, it was one of those. Well, it was awful in that it was a surprise, but it wasn't a shock, if you see what I mean, because things were going so badly for her at that point. But no, I think that, you know, at least she made two outstanding records, and that really was incredible, I think, Back to Black.
I was thinking that, we said she was only 27 years old, but she seemed to have lived a much longer life, which I think reflects on all of that you were saying, that, you know, the troubles that she'd had, and, you know, that idiot who shared her life for the troubled years. He's got a lot to answer for, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, to be fair, I don't think he came out of it much better off, in the sense that I think that his life is a total mess as well. I think, and also I think a lot of the people who have been trying to help him, who I think probably were doing that for her, I think, really, she was someone that seemed to engender a lot of goodwill, get the feeling they might have melted away after Amy Winehouse passed on. So yes, I am. There's you know, you could talk a lot about that story, and there, of course, there's been a film made of it as well, which I watched with very mixed emotions, but I thought was very good. Not an easy watch. It was called Amy, but really interesting. What can you say, really? But at least we still have her records, which I hope will live on forever, because they are so good. One of my favourite go-to cheer me up on a bad day YouTube videos is footage from one of Jules's interminable hootenannies. Speaking of things that go on for a million years, I think it's still going on now, isn't it? They filmed it in October. That was like finding out Father Christmas didn't exist when someone told me that. But there's a video on YouTube of Amy Winehouse and Paul Weller and Jules Holland and the orchestra doing Heard It Through the Grapevine at One Hootenanny, and it is just incredible. It is so good. I would, like I say, it's one of the things, along with CGI Gordon Brown from Taiwan, that always cheers me up when I'm down.
Now, there's a saying that the Beatles are an underrated band, and the inference being that despite their enormous success and longevity of career, they can never be praised enough, and just when you think you know everything about them and heard everything of them, there's a new revelation of joy about them.
Absolutely.
In a different sphere of the arts, there's a group of writers and actors whose work is so outstanding and far-sighted. I feel they're really underrated in a similar way. No matter how many awards or positive reviews, there's always a new level to admire. It's over 20 years ago that Jeremy Dyson, Mark Gatiss, Reese Shearsmith and Steve Pemberton formed an acting troupe, the League of Gentlemen, leading to the BBC series of the same name. And Shearsmith and Pemberton,
and a somewhat less enjoyable film as well.
Shearsmith and Pemberton stayed together to form another series, Psychoville, and then over the last 3 years they've written and starred in what I feel is one of the most extraordinary and skillful series of the modern era, Inside Number 9. Now, Jules, what's so good? What is it about Pemberton, Shearsmith and Inside Number 9?
Oh, well, I mean, I agree with you. I do think it is almost Beatlesque in its kind of genius, really. It is. I mean, funnily enough, it's the first thing they've done that's really done it for me. I went on and off League of Gentlemen. I have to say, although I was a teenager and should have found all the grimness about it really funny and entertaining, the bodily functions, I saw the nosebleed epidemic one, and it kind of put me off for life, really. So I found it a bit scary and a bit, I never really quite got it. I can understand why people really like it, and I could see that it was very good, but it didn't really do it for me. Psychobit, I never really had any interest in. And my parents told me about Inside Number 9 and said, oh, my mum's always badgering me to watch things, and I kind of tuned 90% of it out and shit, but mostly because it's stuff like X Factor. And she said, no, I think you'll really like this. And I was round there, and they said, oh, well, why didn't you watch one? We've taped a couple. And I think I watched four on the spin, and I think they're perfect bits of television. So for anyone that hasn't seen them, they're half an hour long. They usually do a series of about six or eight, and it's on weekly, which if you get really addicted to them, which is addictive, is very frustrating once you've burnt your way through all the previous ones. And each one it's almost impossible to say because they skip from genre to genre. I suppose you could characterise it by saying they quite often have twists or unexpected things that happen in them, and they're the sort of thing that you have to keep watching until the end. And the idea is that they're all at a different destination. They're all completely different characters, completely different story each week, but they're all linked by the fact that it's number nine. So, for example, the restaurant in one of this series is called Inside Number 9, and then in the next one, they go into it. There's one set in a karaoke booth that's number 9, and there's one that the university profession that's room 9. There was a particularly enjoyable one that featured a railway carriage that was number 9, I think, as well, a sleeper train. And they are madly clever. The writing is just sort of genius levels of good. They twist and turn. I was very disappointed. This is the level of how good it is. I was extremely disappointed when I saw last week's and worked out the twist 15 minutes in. I was really sad about that, or rather disappointed when it turned out I was right, because it's the kind of program where you really want to be wrong, because it is the way that it kind of toys with you and twists and turns at the end. This series started with a Christmas special called the Krampus, and it was I don't think it's giving too much away to saying that it's a story within a story, which then has a really rather jaw-dropping twist at the end, which I did not see coming in a million years. I don't think anyone did that saw that. And unfortunately, it's not on iPlayer, but I think you could probably dig it up somewhere, because it is one of the best pieces of television I've ever seen. And when I was thinking the other day about the top five bits of telly I'd ever seen, two of them were Inside Number 9 episodes. And that says a lot, I think, doesn't it? And they're half an hour long, and they are sort of perfectly formed, really.
I think so. I'm a huge fan of Steve Pemberton. He seems to generally go unnoticed when awards are being dished out.
Yes, he does, yeah.
I think he's one of our most talented and versatile actors. I think it's true that he can do sinister simply by entering a room, but
yes,
that versatility is shown time and again. I love E.F. Benson's Map and Lucia novels, and when the BBC produced a television adaptation over Christmas 2014, yes,
filmed it in Rye, which is very near to where I live, and my mum went there for the day and was very excited about having queued behind Anna Chancellor for something.
That's right, the fictional town Tilling is based on Rye.
It is, yeah.
And Steve Pemberton was absolutely delicious as the sort of effete and simpering Georgie Pilsen in Map and Lucia.
Might sound hugely offensive, and I don't mean it to, but for someone who is to all intents and purposes a heterosexual man, apparently he is extremely good at doing kind of simpering camp, sort of, you know, sinister camp. And actually, you're right, they both him and who's the other one, Reese
Shearsmith,
both the thing, I mean, so usually they play the main roles in it, but you get kind of sort of a cameo roles, and they get some really good quality people in it. Keely Hawes is in the last one, I think, which I haven't seen yet. The one set in the karaoke booth had an almost unrecognisable Tamsin Althwaite in it, because she was dressed as Amy Winehouse, funnily enough, and Sarah Hadlam from Miranda, and they get some really sort of good quality people that pop up. You forget who they are. You just realise that they're Sam West was in one, I think, and it only really occurred to me at the end that it was him, if you see what I mean. But the two main guys that do all of the kind of the legwork, really, my mum said it's partly makeup, but also they become different people each week, and it's really telling of their acting skills that they're in every single one, and yet they become these different people. So they're Oxford Dons one week, and then the next week, you know, Reese Shearsmith is a sales rep, and Pemberton is this kind of, you know, depressed middle life boss, and the next week, you know, they're skiing instructors. You know, they are geniuses. I think it's a fantastic program. It's something that I actively look forward to every week, and it's one of those things where you can just watch it and let it take you somewhere, and let it take you to somewhere completely. I mean, the one with the Oxford Dons was about crossword puzzles, and that was just, you know, again, insanely clever. A bit grim, actually, that one, but insanely clever. So it's what can I say? It's one of the best things on telly. Possibly the, given that Fleabag's not on at the moment, I think it is the best thing on telly by far.
I go back to that comparison to the Beatles, because just as like Revolver and Abbey Road have layer upon layer of interest and intrigue, so it is with Inside Number 9. Sort of skillfully written, with that, as I think you were kind of leading towards, that sort of malevolent apocalyptic edge that they specialise in. And it's married. I said the thing I really love about it is that sort of really clever expert filmography.
It's so beautifully shot, isn't it? Yeah.
Oh, you know, with real style. And yet it's tucked away and seems to sort of somehow, the programme's tucked away, seems to exist without any sort of audible fanfare. It isn't available on iPlayer. The first two, the reason being is that they're selling it on DVD and Blu-ray.
Oh, right. So it's only on iPlayer for a limited time.
Exactly.
I've been catching up with them on iPlayer.
They keep them on there for just, you know, a week or two, and then they move off. But they are, you have to pay for them. They're all available for streaming through the BBC digital store.
Yeah, and they're absolutely worth it.
My
other all-time favourite, as well as the Krampus, was, and I think we might have talked about it when we talked about Sheridan Smith previously, The 12 Days of Christine, which had a killer twist at the end. And I thought it was also, you know, much of that was the incredible performance of Sheridan Smith. That really was a one-woman show, I think, compared to many of the others. But having said that, it was wonderfully clever writing, and I paid for that on iTunes because I thought I wanted to see it again, and I very much did. So, I mean, I know we all get spoiled, don't we, in the age of Netflix and things like that, where we can pay, you know, we can pay a small monthly fee and get anything we want, but I would really recommend buying Inside Number 9, because actually, even if you've seen an episode once and you know the twist, there is so much detail in it to be enjoyed. There is so, I mean, the Krampus episode at Christmas, which is done, I don't think it's giving too much away, it's done as a kind of a 1970s kind of, you know, cheap horror play on TV. So many of the details of that are so lovingly done that it is something that rewards rewatching, I think.
And I think, you know, you mentioned Sheridan Smith, who is one of the greatest living actresses we have at the moment.
She's wonderful, isn't she? Yeah.
And yet they pull an extra level, an extra dimension of spirit out of actors and actresses by the very nature of the scripts and the direction and the, as we mentioned, the gorgeous filming.
And the idea, I think, as well, if you're an actor and you were in that, you would up your game, I think, because I genuinely think that it, as well as being, I think it gets reasonably good viewing figures, but I think that it is so critically acclaimed and so loved by anybody that, you know, loves the craft. I know that sounds, you know, pretentious, but you know what I mean? Really cares about that kind of thing. But if you were in that, you'd want to put in a really good performance, wouldn't you? Because it would be so exciting. People ask to be in it, apparently, so it would be so exciting, like you say, to kind of, you would want to pull an extra level out. And I have to say, I couldn't stand Jack Whitehall, and he did a kind of a comic turn in the one that was set in a railway carriage. And I, you know, he didn't play anybody other than himself doing his posh dick, but I have to say, it really worked in that context. And me and my dad were sort of chuckling along throughout. So he was adding Ington to the end of swear words to make new swear words, which we were very keen on. So if it made me like Jack Whitehall, then it must be good, really.
Yeah, as we say, we're available through the BBC digital store. Are you available digitally or in human form this week?
Well, digital is better this week. There's not a lot of me in human form this week. I don't have any engagements this weekend, at least none that I remembered anyway. I have what are we doing? I did my Indie Night last week. That was quite good. I think I'm doing that again in a month. I did play Unbelievable, and people openly after the fact I was playing Unbelievable because it is the most cliched indie disco record ever, but people still danced. So this weekend, there's no Saturday Social, but I am getting better at putting the shows up on Mixcloud now. And have the 1965 Mixcloud episode up this weekend. I am back with Indie Wonderland next week. We had a bit of an all-listener request.
Oh, it was a great program last night.
Which was so much fun. I'm not quite sure if I've got the nerve or the energy to do that again next week, but I am probably going to bring back a listener element to the show, I think, because I do enjoy people's suggestions so much. The unexpected Snuff lobby was quite good, actually. I must admit, lots of people wanted to hear Snuff. But I will do the show again next week. So it's 8 until 10, barricaderadio.com, and my show is called Indie Wonderland. We do have a Twitter, which is @indie_wonder, and I'm on the Twitters as @superjules84.
And that's on next Wednesday.
Wednesday, 8 till 10.
Huge thanks to executive producer Arona. And
indeed, up the row, yeah.
I've always had a soft spot for the works of Duran Duran, and when one of their best songs is married up with the delicious voice of Joy Williams, then we find, well, we're essentially a glorious corner of Nirvana, I suppose. Just released and playing us out this week, this is Joy Williams and Ordinary World.
I'm waving my lighter.
Came in from a rainy Thursday on the avenue. Thought I heard you talking softly. I turned on the lights, the TV and the radio. Still I can't escape the ghost of you. What is happening to it all? Crazy, some say. Where is the life that I recognize? It's gone away, but I won't cry for yesterday. There's an ordinary world. Somehow I have to find. And as I try to make my way to the ordinary world, I will. And I won't cry.
You have been listening to a DACM Media production.